Good afternoon, everybody. Very good. Very pleased to meet you all. And I'm sure there's some familiar faces who perhaps joined us yesterday. I'll just do a little intro before I introduce the three panelists today. Welcome to The Exchange, Greenbelt's venue for thinking about business and how we can make enterprise work better for the common good. The Exchange is supported by Mid-Counties Co-op, Co-op Energy and the Phone Co-op, by Anthony Collins Solicitors, by Cooperatives UK and by New Internationalist magazine. Please do stay and talk to any of them afterwards. There's a full programme of events in the Exchange throughout the festival. Do check out what else is on offer or just come and take advantage of the free Wi-Fi. Now, hopefully you're not all here just for the free Wi-Fi. And just as a way of introduction for those who weren't here yesterday, my name is Stuart Hutton. I'm Chief Investment Officer of a company called Simply Ethical. I'm also a founding emissary of a not-for-profit organisation called the Responsible Finance and Investment Foundation. And as a brief introduction, this is a very serious subject. And as anyone can imagine, there's lots of serious subjects going on at Greenbelt. And I don't necessarily want to repeat what I went through yesterday. And hopefully, if those who are here will remember. But I do want to talk a little bit about, for those who were here, and probably even if you weren't, how we need to be aware of the need for change in the way that our money is handled and directed and spent in a more sustainable economic model. Now, one way we can be more, all can be more influential, is to think about how and where we earn, save, and actually spend our money. And of those, the one where we are less informed is that of where we save it. So by considering the impact of our savings and investments, we can start to influence the way companies manage the environment, dealing with inequalities, and seeking how unjust society can be made just. So before I just start, I want to ask you a quick question for everybody. And you can put your hands in the air, please. Not now, where I haven't asked it. How many of you know where your money is saved and invested? Okay. So leave your hands up if you know the impact your money is having. There we go. Oh, there's still one or two. I'm glad the panelists have their hands up, because otherwise we would be having a real concern here. So, well, hopefully some of those answers will be, those questions will be answered today. So I'm just going to very briefly introduce. So first on my right I have here is Kit Beazley. Kit Beazley has been with Triodos since 2008 and is the UK head of finance. He has over 20 years experience in the financial service industry within planning and strategy in most senior roles that one can imagine you could be in. Since the beginning of this year, he has been seconded into the UK head of Brexit implementation. I told you we'd get that reaction. A role that I am sure will encourage many great questions later on. We then have on the end actually Rob Norman. So for those of you who have visited the Exchange already and seen some of the speakers, Rob needs no introduction to you. As campaign managers for the New Internationalist, his background for anyone interested in the cooperative movement is essential reading. I'm sure he'll expand on that, and obviously please do go and see them at their stand. And then the final panelist, the gentleman in the middle here, is Martin Rich from Future Fit Foundation. He is the co-founder and executive director and is an impact investment specialist with over 20 years experience in both mainstream and social investment. FYI, of that, for 13, he was in investment banking. But we won't hold that against him. I see, I told you to get that reaction as well. I thought we could do like boo, away. But anyway. So I'm just going to start off briefly with a quote before I hand over to Kit. And the first quote I want to say is this. The problem is not that people don't want to help others. The problem is they don't know who to trust and whether they're actually going to make any difference to someone's life. So, on that note, I'm going to hand to Kit, who's going to introduce himself and talk a little bit about that.
Great. Thanks very much, Stuart. So was anyone at Kate Raworth's talk yesterday about donut economics? Great. Okay. And the fair trade talk? Less. Okay. So, all right. So I'm going to introduce... Who's heard of Triodos Bank? Magic. Okay. Well, I can't. So that's amazing. It's great. So basically... We're talking about reimagining finance. So as an introduction to Triodos, if you don't know kind of more about it, imagine a bank that basically lives donut economics, okay? The mission, Triodos's mission is to make money work for positive social, environmental, and cultural change. We are in business to enable individuals, businesses, organizations to do that with their savings and their investments, okay? Another difference, our strategy actually starts with looking at what are the issues in society that need some money to help them solve them. Who are the people with some ideas on how to solve it? And who are the people with some money that would like to help them solve it? How do we connect those three things? The idea, the problem, the idea, and the people with the money to lend. So that's basically what we do. That is our strategy. We did crowdfunding 25 years ago, before anybody called it crowdfunding. In fact, in a sense, we are a crowdfunded bank. It was called Triodos Renewables, and it's called Triodos Bank. It was effectively a crowdfunding exercise. Another difference, we're transparent about who we lend to. So how can you possibly be conscious about how your money is being used if your bank doesn't tell you where they're lending it or investing it? So we are transparent. You can go to our website, go to knowwhereyourmoneygoes.co.uk. You will see a complete list of everyone that we lend to and everyone that, that our funds invest in, okay, globally. We're only funded by deposits, so we don't borrow from any other banks at all. We're kind of more insulated, if you like, from the financial markets. We don't pay any bonuses. We only pay our CEO, well, we're transparent about the multiple of the CEO's salary, the highest to the lowest salaries, which is something that has taken a long time to catch on in UK financial reporting. It's now finally getting there. But I can tell you that our CEO is only paid, he's paid less than 10 times the lowest, no, the median salary in the bank. That's very different from other banks. So we are about changing finance and financing change. So we do a lot of lobbying on how the financial system needs to change as well. So we are in direct contact with government, with the regulators. We have published a report called Pathways to Change. We are talking to the EU about how financial regulation could change. We're talking about changing the capital charges for banks so that the risks that are inherent in investments in carbon start getting recognized in the capital requirements for banks. So it's we're really, really trying to push some of those things. And the final difference, I mean, basically our annual report is as much, possibly more, about the impact that our savers and investors' money is having than about all that sort of financial and governance stuff. So what you will find in our annual report is a load of stuff about the Sustainable Development Goals, what are we doing about them, how are we contributing to them, how many people are benefiting from the arts and culture stuff that we do, how many people are in care homes as a result of finance from Triodos, all of that stuff. So that impact is really visible and transparent. Okay, that's probably enough about Triodos.
Thank you, Kit. I feel, next, I'm going to move on to Martin. Martin, in a hip-hop style, can you perhaps talk a little bit about... I feel with the beat going behind, maybe we can kind of start swaying or something.
This is very me, actually.
Oh, it's Martin. Like, Martin and I share a love of a particular progressive rock group called Marillion. So, unfortunately...
That's the other one!
He's even got
He's got the T-shirt. Mate.
That was not a plant, by the way, everybody. You know. But when I first spoke to Martin a few weeks back and introduced myself, I was trying to look for a quick, how I could kind of build a relationship. And I'd seen a video of him talking at an event, and he mentioned this Marillion. I thought, that's it, we're in. And we spoke for about half an hour about Marillion before we actually got onto banking. But anyway, but Martin, in your own style, please, introduce yourself and obviously about yourself.
Love to. Cheers. Well, if nothing else from today, you can actually all go home and say you have genuinely met an investment banker called Mr. Rich. Totally true. I mean, God couldn't have, you know, done it any better, really, could it? So very quick background, because it's sort of relevant to why I founded Future Fit. So I spent 13 years as an investment banker. I was a derivative structurer and marketer for JP Morgan, UBS, and HSBC. I didn't personally cause the financial crisis, so please don't stone me. I know some of the people who did. It's quite interesting. But I did that for 13 years, and then around the time of the crisis, I actually reinvented and went into the social investment space. So I started working for an organization called Social Finance, where I was a sales director, and I spent the next 7 years selling social investments, investments that were trying to fund charity social enterprises, organizations where social mission was at the heart of what they were doing. And having gone from the sublime to the ridiculous, I began to sort of realize that there was a fundamental problem at the heart of finance, which was just this complete lack of understanding of what the impact, good or bad, of any investment, any organization was. So while we were all trying to run around and do more good and less harm, which is a good thing, there was actually no standard way of talking about this around the world. And that might sound a bit boring to you, but actually, if you think of any of the organizations where you work, if there are not standardized ways of doing things, of measuring things, of understanding things, of common language, then actually trying to do anything at scale just doesn't work. And the global financial system is so integrated, so complex, so international, that actually we have to have this common method of understanding. So I set up this thing called the Future Fit Foundation, which is to try and show organizations, any business, what does it mean to not be damaging the planet or society in the way it does business? So how does it not breach system boundaries, system science boundaries, and actually how does it go beyond that and start to restore planet and society? For those of you who are familiar with Kate Raworth's donut, another way to put it is we show people in actions how to live in the sweet bit of the donut. How do you live in that ring? How do you stop damaging things? And how do you start reinforcing the planetary boundaries? How do you help start making things better? So that's what my organization now does. And the challenge that I want to put out to all of you today is, yes, we're talking about how to make an impact with your money, and we're going to be focusing mainly on the finance part, where do you invest? But more than that, how do you make the money that you make? For those of you who work, are employees or employers, what does the organization you work for actually do? How are you furthering our mission on this planet through your products and your services and how you go about doing that business? Do you even know? Do you have a corporate purpose? Do you know what your company's purpose is? Does it have one? Is it damaging the people in the supply chains or the natural resources that you use to create your products? Are your products recyclable? How much packaging is in them? Have you even thought about asking any of these questions to your colleagues? If you have, brilliant, well done. If you haven't, start thinking about that when you go back to work next week or the week after, whenever it is. We talked at the start about the three things. Where do you earn? Where do you spend? Where do you invest? Where do you spend your money? When you spend, you are, if you like, we used the term beforehand, voting with your money. What does the way you spend your money say about you, your values, and the companies where you are putting that cash? We all need to probably buy less. We certainly need to get rid of the word consumer from our lexicon. Again, if nothing else today, please stop using the word consumer, because consume means you take, you use, you destroy, and it's gone. Let's start thinking ourselves of as stewards of what we have and what we use. We need to buy less. We need to recycle more. We need to repurpose more. We need to repair more. Have you thought about how these things are changing your daily life? Hopefully you all at least recycle. Hopefully you all think a little bit about where you spend money. Great. Do that more. Encourage your friends and your family to do that more. And the investing is what we're going to talk about more today. But again, do you know where your money is? Have you thought about which bank you're using? Have you thought about where is your pension? Where are your savings, your ISAs? How many of you use Triodos as an example? Yay, at least one. Handful. Brilliant. Good. So some of you have made some good positive change already. These are the things we need to be thinking about, because we are all the system. Sounds like a Pussy Riot thing to say, doesn't it? You know, we are. But we are. We are all savers. We are all investors. We are all workers. We are all consumers. We are all stewards. So actually, all of this stuff is interlinked. And if we don't think about how we're affecting that system, then we won't get the long-term systemic change that we need. The tyranny of the horizons means we will all make short-term decisions and say everybody else should be making the long-term decisions that will get us where we need to be. We all need to start thinking in that way. At which point, I'll hand over to Rob.
Thank you very much, Martin. Excellent. I noticed you didn't ask the audience how many people bank with Barclays. Oh, no. But, you know, because, I mean, or HSBC, yes, beg your pardon, yeah. And it's a very mute point because, that's right, the actions we take as individuals, we don't often see the impact that has further down the road. And that's something we may come back to address kind of shortly. But before I do that, I'd like to pass on to Rob, who's going to kind of knit this back together again, I think, from your perspective and the role you do within the media and everything else goes on. So, Rob, please.
So, yeah, so... thank you, Stuart. So as Stuart says, I work for New Internationalist. So I'm the non-financier on the panel. I'm not a financial expert by any means. I don't work for the Financial Times. I work for New Internationalist, which is, you know, a publication that tends to focus on social justice and looks at the politics of these issues. So rather than, you know, try ambitiously to talk about finance in the way these guys have, I'm going to stick to what I know, which is social justice and politics. And I'm just going to make one very simple point. And that point is that although I agree with everything that's been said so far, it's not just about what choices you make, what ethical choices you make within the pre-existing markets. But what's also important is how we reform markets themselves, how we actually change markets themselves. So these sessions are they're called Reimagining Finance. And the thing I really want to stress about reforming markets is the importance of interdependence. You know, when it comes to reimagining finance, the reason why we have to do that is because, you know, the current financiers have a distinct lack of imagination when it comes to discussing their pay packets. So I kind of get tired of hearing, you know, people who have made their millions on financial markets of talking about, you know, having been self-made men, having made their millions through their own endeavor. And they talk as if they're entirely self-sufficient. They talk as if they've done it entirely themselves, and they forget that, you know, they're dependent on the lives of millions and millions of people, not just, you know, the people that drive their buses that get them to work, not just the teachers that taught them at schools or the people that made their computers, but also in a wider sense, they're also dependent on, you know, the public sector, and they're dependent on history. You know, the vast majority of wealth that exists in this world is an inheritance from history. It's not, you know, it's not an individual inheritance, it's a social inheritance. We all inherit it from, you know, generations from the past. And so if it's a joint inheritance, then we should have a more egalitarian way of distributing those resources. So the typical reply from that will normally be that, you know, financiers talk about how they make their money through markets and how, you know, I produced a product, I sold it on a market, and it was popular, you know. It was obviously very valuable to a lot of people, and so I deserve my millions because, you know, I've provided something that people want, and therefore I'm providing a social function. But what they forget to mention a lot of the time is that a lot of those markets that they made their money on were actually made by the financial sector themselves. So, you know, there's no better industry at making markets than the financial sector, you know, from futures markets to options markets to over-the-counter markets to all kinds of weird and wonderful clandestine, you know, ways of making markets. And of course, most famously, derivative markets. So, you know, it was housing derivative markets 10 years ago that famously led to the financial crash. And it wasn't just the fact that they made those markets. You know, we as a society allowed them to make those markets by pursuing a kind of free market neoliberal approach to politics and to market making. So I guess the key point I'm trying to make here is that markets aren't a natural thing. It's very, you know, often people kind of think of markets as being a natural thing. People compare market justice to social justice. You know, Friedrich Hayek famously said there is no such thing as social justice. There is only market justice. And it's very easy to think of markets as being a kind of the natural order of things. And really the point I want to make is that they are, markets are always a political and social construct. So I know Stuart likes quotes, so I thought I'd slip a little quote in. So the Frederick Jameson quote that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. For a lot of people, I think that seems to be true. I do a workshop at universities on inequality, and one of the questions I always ask in that workshop is, who deserves to be paid more, a nurse or Wayne Rooney? And in asking that question, you know, many people in the room will usually say, you know, a nurse, obviously a nurse saves lives, blah, 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 and that's great. But there's always a portion of the room that doesn't really understand the question. They look at me and sort of say, well, what do you mean who deserves to be paid more? I mean, you know, they just are paid more. That's just the natural order of things. And actually, that's not the case at all. You know, like I say, markets have always been a political construct, and we forget that at our peril. I mean, I'm not anti-market. That's not to say I'm anti-market. I think capitalism is the best system of, you know, producing mass wealth that the world has ever seen. But where we go wrong is mistaking markets and mistaking capitalism for a system of social justice and for a system of environmental justice. The irony of allowing markets to become a system of social justice is that the markets that we have are actually the product of social injustice in the first place. When I say they're a product of social injustice, I'm referring very specifically to inequality. So, you know, everyone knows we're living in a very unequal world. I think inequality is at its highest since, in the post-war era. And the fact is that they're made because of the concentration of wealth. You know, the 0.01% have enormous political power, you know, lobbying power, power through the media, power through academia, advertising, and obviously through political capture in America, that's where it's most evident. You know, politics has always been a battle between money and between democracy, and if we allow money to be concentrated in very few hands, then, you know, political power will be in the hands of a few, and markets will be formed in, you know, ways that suit those people. So I guess it then all comes back to where I started, which is really the importance of interdependence and the importance that we realise how interdependent society is, and therefore the importance of how we make money we make markets to reflect that in a more egalitarian way, you know, bringing in support for cooperatives, for support for, you know, organisations like the organisations that these guys have, municipalisation, public ownership, reform of, you know, ownership of PLCs. You know, there are all kinds of different ways of reforming markets. But also in terms of acknowledging the importance of interdependence in terms of our political responsibilities and the fact that, you know, we all have to reach out, and if we are going to change things, we have to do it by working together. You know, this is Greenbelt's a Christian festival and, you know, a faith-based festival, and I do really want to stress the importance of, you know, reaching out to people from other faith groups that, you know, share the values of people here, and to secular groups as well, to actually, you know, if we really want to change things and if we really want to see markets in the kind of egalitarian way that we're going to be talking about on this panel, then we have to do it by working together. Okay, that's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. A worthy applause, and thank you for all three for the opening. And it's a very interesting point. Yesterday we were talking about one point, and there was an issue raised around the money available from collecting zakat, this compulsory giving that they do, and that the hundreds of billions of dollars that are not being applied. And it seemed there was an easy solution: grab that, apply it, and we're done. It's not a sustainable economic model. It's not the easiest way to do things. And another point was made around the Christian focus of giving and how so many good charities are doing such good work around the world. How do we measure this? How do we manage that? And in fact, that's really helpful. But one thing we were talking about earlier, I'd like to pick up now and ask all three of you to follow through, is we're all sitting here, and some of us are doing some things in the right direction. But, you know, what have we got to do to understand to help people like us make those decisions? So can you perhaps give some insight into that?
So I think I'll just pick one word: transparency. So I think at Triodos we try to make ourselves very, very transparent about everything that we do. I've talked about that. But I think it's also, so Martin was talking about, you know, how many questions do we actually ask of some of the other institutions that we interact with? You know, how many of us have asked where our pensions are being invested? You know, and it's actually incredibly hard to find out. It takes a lot of effort, but also actually people hide behind all sorts of excuses for not telling it as well. So, you know, we have proved, and actually another bank in the UK has now, it's a charity bank, I think, have followed our example in publishing a list of who they lend to. But there actually is no reason why everybody shouldn't do the same and make themselves kind of open to criticism or discussion with their customers about where their money is going. So I would just pick transparency. It's really hard to find out. Maybe if people asked more, they might find out, but it is quite hard.
Yeah, and I think it's what people have to realize is companies ultimately respond to money, which comes from investment and it comes from you as customers. And if we just all carry on, nothing will change. We will go roaring through 2 degrees warming, probably north. So at the moment, the expectation is we're going to hit about 3.1 degrees. So don't know whether any of you have ever studied that. That's not good. Doesn't feel like much. 3.1 is bad. Could be useful today. It would be quite nice. But that is the symptom of just carrying on buying the same things, working in the same way, doing what we do. We have to change. Now, the good news is there is a growing wave of transparency, to Kit's point, coming, particularly in the financial industry. We are seeing slowly more and more things opening up. We're seeing more ethical businesses. We're seeing far more organizations trying to point to all of the good stuff that they're doing. Now, there's a huge amount of greenwashing and bluewashing going on within all of that. But at least they're beginning to realize. Why are they telling that story? They're only telling that story because they think you're interested. And yeah, it sells, but at least people are genuinely interested. So the more that you show that you want to see the truth behind these pieces, that you say, actually, I don't want child slave labor in my supply chains. I'm concerned about people throwing themselves off the balcony in Foxconn to put an iPhone in my pocket. I'm concerned about children working in cotton fields so that I can wear the latest cool piece of kit. I'm concerned about microfibers coming out of all of probably most of the waterproof kit that we're all wearing here today that's putting plastic into the oceans. I want these things to be done differently. But it's only by asking the question and then following it through. Because time and time again, you see these surveys where they say, we interviewed the mum outside Tesco's and said, would you buy the slave-traded, blood-stained T-shirt? Or would you buy the fairly traded, fluffy T-shirt? And of course, when you get asked that in a questionnaire, guess what the answer is? You know, 85% say they do this. Then they go inside the store and 93% of them buy the cheapest one. So we have to understand the impact. We have to accept that there will be a cost and a change of lifestyle. And we have to act on that, otherwise we only have ourselves to blame.
And the question I was going to ask you, but you then answered it, was to explain what does stewardship mean? And in fact, you've answered that in some ways, because as shareholders or as people where we're engaging that, owning something is one thing, but actually taking a care about it and understanding what stewardship means is where we then start to have the impact and influence the differences needed. Rob, be interested in your thoughts on this.
I mean, I agree with everything that's been said. I guess I'd come back to kind of what I was talking about in terms of the importance of the politics. I mean, I remember when I first discovered Ecotricity. Hands up if you've heard of Ecotricity. So almost everyone. Yeah. I mean, I just thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. I was really conscious of my carbon footprint and the fact that I was doing more harm than good, even though I was scared of climate change more than anything, really. And I discovered Ecotricity and I thought, great, this is the answer to everything. They provide electricity that's sourced entirely from renewable energy. They actually offer the same rate as the big six. You know, what could be easier? All you have to do is ring them up. They'll convert you over. You know, easy as Larry. Surely everyone's going to be doing this within the next couple of years. So, I thought it was absolutely amazing. But the fact is that even though the vast majority of the population, as Martin said, most people do have ethical values. Most people don't want to see climate change happen and continue in the way it has. But yet they don't go to Ecotricity. I think it's still something like 1 or 2% of the population actually use Ecotricity. So, market choices like that alone aren't going to come about. And the thing with climate change is that time is not on our side. We need to act very, very quickly. And so we can't wait for everyone to convert to Ecotricity in order to, stop climate change happening. So I feel like, it ultimately has to come from the top as well. It can't just be a grassroots thing. We have to reform the way we do our politics. And that means legislation and incentives for organizations like Ecotricity.
Hold on to that mic, Rob. I've got to follow up that. One of the things that's key in all these type of areas is education. Can you perhaps, and we'll come back down again, to kind of think about how, you know, why education is so important and relevant to this? Because the one thing that seems to slip up, you're in the media, so you have the opportunity to put a voice out. You know, with other organisations, often it's a difficult perspective because they seem to be deemed as corporate marketing. Yeah. So, you know, we're good, by us. You know, and so from your perspective, how important is this education piece around this?
I mean, it's absolutely crucial. Yeah, I guess it's a funny one with the media because you know, we've talked a lot about finance and we're talking about reimagining finance. The media, you know, even the right wing tabloid media, the way that, you know, their rhetoric is very hostile to the financial world. They talk very negatively. Like anyone who ever reads the Daily Mail would know that they, you know, the Daily Mail are actually very anti the financial industry on, you know, in terms of their rhetoric, in terms of what they say. They know that everyone's angry with the banks because of the financial crash in 2008. And so they can't then say, you know, the bankers are great, everything's hunky-dory, things are brilliant. They know that they wouldn't sell their newspapers. So their rhetoric is very negative, but actually if you look at the detail, you know, the thing that a lot of the tabloid press tend to be is very nationalistic. And that's how they end up kind of justifying, you know, in an age of globalization, in an age of, you know, global markets, the way that they kind of justify the status quo is by talking about the competitiveness of companies within the UK. You know, we can't increase taxes on kind of corporations, or we can't increase, you know, regulations on the financial industry because that will make the UK less competitive. We're doing it for the country, and they kind of talk in kind of national terms, yeah. And that's where it becomes extremely misleading because ultimately all they're doing is kind of advocating a kind of, you know, status quo, kind of neoliberal, business-friendly, non-ethical approach. So I think, you know, being aware of that, you know, is crucial, and education, you know, within the media and the responsibility of the media to be more outward looking, to be more internationalist, is absolutely crucial.
Martin, could you pick up from a business perspective and what you're doing, because that's quite relevant to this part, because in terms of education, and we haven't mentioned the SDGs. I mean, who has heard of the SDGs? Yeah, so, I mean, this is, again, doesn't surprise me because they're not out there. This is, you know, something that's been put as a marker for 11 years' time that we need to achieve, and it's not commonly driven out, even though the actual initial consultation had over 5 million people worldwide, and almost every government in the world has signed up to it. It's not being driven through, and it's got to come through from individuals and businesses, and that's part of what you're doing in your role. Perhaps you can give a little bit around the education piece as well.
Yeah, sure. I think the key point here is that we're not actually talking about nirvana.
Why and not? I don't mean Sounds the band. Good.
We can do this. We know what the boundary conditions, if I can use that expression, are. We know how to do business in a way where social and environmental justice is embedded into the very nature of what they do. Typically, today, we see that happening through, you know, so-called social enterprises, small businesses that kind of have more freedom to do that. But the work that Kate Raworth has done, what she's shown with the donut, what we show at Future Fit, is how businesses actually get to that point. It's not all that complicated. It's hard to do from where we are today. You know, you wouldn't start here. But things like making sure everybody gets paid at least a living wage, zero greenhouse gas emissions from your operations or through your supply chains, paying the right tax in the right place at the right time. Guidelines like that, that's what FutureFit has created, a complete set of those, and that's what we're now working with some of the biggest companies and investors in the world to start embedding into their organizations. We can do it, but there are some fundamentally huge shifts that are required within some organizations. Goals like products shall not harm people or the planet, quite difficult if you're selling oil for burning, or guns, or tobacco. You know, but society wants guns and society wants tobacco, because if it didn't, we wouldn't have them. So it's not that we don't know where those boundaries are, but the question is then, collectively, do we want to get there? Now, what the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, have set out is a vision by 2030 of the world we want. No poverty is goal number one. Then there's all sorts of stuff about health and the environment and all these things. They're great. The problem is they are a vision that were put together by about 5 million people. and a whole load of NGOs and governments. Now, has anybody ever worked in a committee? Right? You'll be familiar with the expression, you know, decision by committee, right? And the problem is the SDGs are a great vision, but they are not a cohesive, non-overlapping, collaborative set of goals. And the private sector actually wasn't very heavily involved in their creation. Paul Polman of Unilever, the chief exec, was involved. I think there was one finance guy, might be Mark Wilson from Aviva, not sure. Yeah. But that was about it. Yeah. And now the whole private sector has been told, get on with the SDGs. Yeah. And actually in corporate world and investor world, these are huge right now. Everybody is panicking about what to do. But what does no poverty actually mean to a business, really? Or life on land is one of the other SDGs. What does that mean? Life on land. What, we want more of it? So trying to... down with the kids. So trying to convert that, and again, what we've tried to do is we've tried to show people how these actions link through to the SDGs and can make a difference. But there again is this massive rift between the world saying, this is what we want, and then, oh, now we're going to dump it on the private sector and tell them how to do it. And the private sector's gone, might be nice to involve us in the discussion, guys. So they're trying, but again, we didn't go around doing that in a very great way.
But the challenge here is because I think the private sector would not have come up with the same goals necessarily.
No, absolutely it wouldn't. But then involve them in the discussion to create them.
And it would have been another 10 years before they decided. I suppose the key thing here is that the private sector rules. You know, the corporates as well run, and the governments are heavily influenced by that.
To Rob's point, only if we let them.
True. And that's why there's an opportunity now to say, well, okay, you can rule it, but this is the way we're going. And I think that's the direction of travel. There is an opportunity that kind of belies that, hopefully, that maybe will be an awakening. Because believe me, as you talked about climate change is not a reversible process. You know, this continues and we're just slowing it down as best we can, but the damage is done. And you know, we need to address this today. We need to address it now. And therefore, how do you do that on a planet of over 7 billion people that's going to probably grow to 10.6 billion in the next kind of, you know, 50-odd years? So there are key things that need, and there's going to be a lot to it. Kit, do you want to pick up from that? Because again, the education piece is quite a useful perspective because we've talked around that. And I think you at Triodos obviously have an implementation around that anyway, but I think also from a broader perspective as a business and your, you know, your own views, there's some quite useful anecdotes as well.
Yeah, so I suppose the starting point is I would say that people probably think that the world of finance and banking is more complicated than it really is. Okay, so a bank should be a really, really simple thing, okay, where one bunch of people deposit some money, and as much as possible of that money is lent out to another bunch of people who need it. And some is held back because generally the lending is for a bit longer than people are prepared to put their savings there. So there's a bit held back as what's called liquidity. So it's just there, it's readily available if people want to take their money out. That should be basically all banking is. It should be a mechanism for transmitting people who've got the money from people who have got more than they need or who don't need it right now to the people who actually could do something worthwhile with it, okay? And then what happened in banking was it got very, very complicated because people thought, oh, do you know what? We could deliver a higher return on equity if instead of using all of that money for lending out to businesses, we could play around with some of that on the stock market or with derivatives or stuff like that. So what you find is that you've got sustainable banks who lend typically somewhere around 70 to 80% of the money that is deposited with them. And what are called the G-SIFIs, the globally significant financial institutions, who typically lend about 30 to 40%. They actually hold less liquidity, and the difference is what they play around with, and that's what caused the crash in 2008. Okay? So banking should be simple, but it's not. Now, and the reason I say that is that we did a survey a few years ago, and we discovered that about 30% of people don't realize that banks actually lend their money back out again. They thought that it just sort of sits in a vault somewhere. So I'm sorry if you're one of that 30%. I just want to disabuse you of that, okay? The way banks make money is they make a bit more money from what they lend than what they pay to their depositors, and that bit in the middle covers the costs of running the bank, and it covers the costs of paying a fair return to the shareholder, okay? So that's the first point, okay? Money, when you put it into a bank, it is going to go somewhere, and that bank is going to do something with it. So just hold that thought, because that thought is the same for when you have your money put into a pension fund. It also applies to your insurance. So when you put your money with an insurer, whether it's a life insurer or a general insurer, while in between the time that you've given them the money and they've paid it back out to you as a claim, they are making money by investing that somewhere else. Okay? So all these people are doing something with your money. And I think that's a really important point that people don't understand. And they think of the financial system, and they think of themselves as being completely powerless in this really, really complicated financial system. But actually, basically, it's pretty simple. You trust somebody with your money, and they'll do something with it to make some money until you need it back again. Okay? So that's probably the first thing. That is the most important thing, I think, about education, is just understanding the way the financial system works. Okay? And then the second thing is that means you've got power. Okay? You are users of the financial system. You can vote with your money. Okay? Who remembers apartheid and Barclays? Okay? Look at the impact that had on Barclays. Lots of people said, we don't like the fact that you're investing in South Africa and you've got a big operation in South Africa. They really sat up and listened. Imagine what would happen if people took the same view on, you know, the some of the investments that are being made by the big banks now. And they thought, do you know what? I really don't like the idea that all of the big banks in the UK are investing in the Three Gorges Dam project, which displaced millions of people in China in order to build a whopping great hydroelectric dam. Okay, hydroelectric, great, but look at the social impact and the social and environmental injustice that created by flooding millions of square miles. It's just, you know, so if people really sort of move their money around, and yet, well, so question, how many people here bank with the same bank that their parents did? And how many people have ever switched their current account? Fantastic. That is really unusual. Okay, so current accounts, I mean, the switching stats on current accounts are really pathetic. It's dead easy. It can take you less than a week to switch your current account, and yet people don't do it. Okay, and there are lots of reasons, like, you know, it's tied to a set-off mortgage or something like that. But lots of people could move, and they don't. And I'm really glad that you guys have done that. And most people, when I ask that question about the parents, most hands go up. Because most people just bank with the bank that was opened by their parents, and they just stayed there forever. Okay, so you guys are a relatively well-informed activist audience. Just think how you could use your power.
That's Greenbelt for you. One thing you didn't mention, of course, is you talked about this simple, what they call fractional reserve banking. Yeah, so where, you know, to use the terminology, where they're making money from your money. The other thing is they also create money by holding your money. So, and I'm not going to go into the semantics in detail now, because I really promise you would all fall asleep. But, you know, for every pound you put in, another £100 is created. And that the whole perspective around this creates the danger. I mean, I'm being flippant here, but, you know, totally. We're getting kind of, you know, well into this hour here. And I want to be able to give you guys and girls a chance to ask a question to these guys here. So I'm going to throw it out to you. I normally warn you, sorry about this, but has anybody got a question they'd like to ask the panel? Great, look at his hands up. Right, well, this you'll let Handy go up first, so you won. Here we go.
I'll bring the mic to you.
Hi. So I'm at one of the universities that had this big blow up about how much their vice chancellor was paid earlier in the year. So we had this big sit down debate. One of the kind of reconciliation things that happened was he held a meeting, and where we were supposed to ask him questions about how much he gets paid, what he actually does, who he was. Most of us had never seen him before. And he got paid about £800,000, I think, a year. He was one of the big ones. And he gets a very nice big free house. And he essentially justified how much he was paid because he said, it's okay, I do nice things with my money. So I guess what I'm asking is, does investing a lot of money well make up for how you earn your money in the first place?
What? No, I don't really want to. That is
good
a
question.
Cracker. That
good
is a question. Really, really good question. And actually, that goes right to the heart of it. So, does it make up for it? I think I would say it's going to be hard, because the thing is that if you are paid that much compared to other people, no matter what you do with that money, it says something about your perceived status, okay? And I'm not sure that that's a good thing, okay? I had a very interesting discussion with a very good friend who is a partner in one of the big accounting firms, who I know is paid, or at least, yeah, takes away quite a lot of money. And I basically sort of said, well, you know, okay, so if you're going to be really generous, let's say you want 2 foreign holidays and you've got 3 kids at private school, and let's say you want a second home, and I don't know, you know, you want to pay 20% of your salary into a pension fund or whatever it was. I was struggling to get beyond justifying more than about £300,000 or £400,000. And that was pretty generous. I was being very, very generous, knowing that they were being paid quite a lot more than that. And it was a very interesting look on their face. So I think the short answer is no, I don't think it does, because even if that money is going to all sorts of good causes and being well invested, it's still the fact that somebody perceives their self-worth as being that much more than somebody else feels to me questionable.
Interesting. One of the comments I had back from somebody in a similar situation was, well, I do pay an awful lot of taxes. But I can also avoid quite a lot as well, because I can afford to pay for the advice.
Sorry, go on. Fine. So next investment banker answering this question, eh?
You don't have to give your salary away.
I won't. No, it absolutely doesn't justify it. I mean, you know, some of the best paid industries in the world are not ones that you can then offset. I mean, being an arms dealer is an extraordinarily good way to make money. It's quite risky, but you can actually make a huge amount of money. You know, how many people's screams does that then offset? You know, no, of course it can't. But I think the only thing I'd say, not just to repeat what Kit said, I think let's not conflate two issues here. One is, what is your responsibility to steward what you've got? Now, you know, whether you believe that's because God has given you that, or whether you just believe that's what you've earned or whatever, doesn't matter. You have a responsibility to steward that money well, whether you're paid $800,000 a year or $8,000 a year. That, to me, is a slightly different question then to why is that job being paid £800,000 a year when a nurse is being paid, £18,000-£20,000, probably not even that. So that, and as an individual, you very rarely get to set your own salary. I mean, you know, probably everybody goes in and argues for a bit more because that's just sort of what you do, but why is your university setting the level there? Why are chief executives around the world earning higher and higher and higher multiples? That actually, to me, is the more important question. And we're back to this panel. Actually, it's time that we start turning around and saying, I don't care whether you're a nice person who does nice things with your money. That job is just not worth that level of salary. And we could use 400,000. I mean, you know, you could halve that. The guy's still going to do quite nicely, and your university's got another £400,000 that it can go and do something useful with, or buy more beer for the bar or something. So, you know, it is useful. So that, to me, there's two issues in that.
I hate to sound like a one-trick pony, but I guess what your vice chancellor is forgetting is how interdependent we are. You know, they you know, maybe your vice chancellor is in charge of an endowment fund for, you know, £30 million, and they're investing it in all kinds of ethical things. But what they're forgetting is that, you know, where does that endowment fund come from? You know, where does the money for that endowment fund come from? Where do the decisions in terms of how that money is distributed come from? They're not just made by one person. You know, it's an interdependent process. They're part of a committee. They're part of a management structure. They're part of a huge organization that's made up of all kinds of different people that contribute in all kinds of different ways. And the idea that that one person deserves to be paid £800,000 a year because they're at the end of that process, that doesn't make sense. You know, they're standing on the shoulders of millions, and you know that interdependence goes, you know, runs throughout the entire society, and it's an international thing. And so I think what they've enabled themselves to do is capture the wealth at the top and not acknowledge that interdependence that's beneath them.
Okay, thank you. There's a lot of people indicated they want to ask questions, so I'm going to take 2 questions at a time, and we're going to try and see if we can move through these to help with that. Okay, so this gentleman and this lady here, because they're close to each other.
I have my savings and a lot of my investments with Triodos, and I did that as an ethical decision. But I also made the decision to maintain my current account with NatWest, and the reason for that is because I'm concerned about that there is a lack of local banking facilities in local communities. And I'd just like to know what your thoughts are on the effects of communities when local banks close. And as long as NatWest continue to run a local bank in my area, then I will continue to put my current account there.
So you mentioned the idea of people being able to trying to go and ask, you know, to your pension provider, you know, where are you investing my money? As someone who has an employment pension, I don't get a choice in who that pension is held with. My company choose that for me and they pay into it on my behalf. Are there any resources that we can access easily to find out how good some of these providers are from either a banking, like current account point of view, pension point of view? Where should we go when actually if I email Scottish Widows or whoever it might be, chances are they're not going to reply or I'm going to get a very unhelpful reply.
Right, who's going first with that? Martin?
All right, I'll grab the pensions one. So your pension scheme will have trustees. So they should be your first port of call. Go and annoy them lots and say to them, I want to understand where our scheme's being invested. I want to understand what the impact of that money is. Are there any ethical options within that? You may, it depends what scheme you've got, but you may actually be able to choose between some of the funds. So you may actually be able to switch it up a little bit, not a lot, but tell them you want more ethical options. You want low carbon options or whatever it might be. So write to the trustees, and they are the trustees of your scheme. You are a member. They have to respond to you. They cannot ignore you. They don't have to do what you tell them to, but they have to respond. So get some other people in your business. One group that are worth looking up is a group called Share Action. It used to be called Fair Pensions, now called Share Action. Catherine Howarth, chief exec, she's awesome. They spend all of their time going to AGMs of big companies and basically being annoying and asking awkward questions. So look at what they do. They're a good group that maybe you can sort of get involved with a little bit.
So, yeah, I would definitely echo that. Scottish Widows have a very small number of ethical funds that you can put your money in. My money used to be with Scottish Widows. I've now moved it to Aviva because they have a lot more, a much bigger variety, and they charge less. But So the local banking one, yeah, that's a really difficult one because that, in a way, that's a bit like the, you know, do I buy fair trade from sort of Africa or do I buy something locally? And, you know, I actually think, no, you're right. Banking and banks are still of quite an important local resource. We simply cannot afford to run a branch network. And actually what's turning out to be the case is that most of the big banks can't afford to run a branch network. What I hope is that gradually alternative forms will emerge. So the post office is now starting to do much more for a lot of different banks to provide a local sort of banking, you know, a banking interface, if you like. But yeah, I completely understand. And actually, I think the important thing is that you've thought about it. And that you've thought about why is it that I want to carry on banking with NatWest, and you know you can make that choice, and then you can do something worthwhile with the money that you're putting with Triodos or anybody else, and you're also supporting the community by keeping that branch open. All credit to you. You thought about it.
I think one of the questions often comes out is, you know, we need banking, but not necessarily banks. Is kind of often the phrase. We've got two questions over here.
Hi. I mean, for me, I suppose I'm a bit disappointed that we're not really reimagining very much. So, in a way, to tell us that the high street banks can't really afford to have local branches anymore, not sure that they can't afford to. It's a choice. Or that the SDGs weren't really created with private sector in mind. When really what we want to do is reimagine how we can do our money. That actually, the obviously, you know, with my monthly salary, maybe I could do a bit. But what we need to think about is about systems. And I'm curious to know, because you guys know a lot more about this than I do. You know, what are the potential system changes we can get so that we can have a more imaginative solution to the inequality and the climate change and all the things that everybody here in Greenbelt is angry about? And I feel like accepting that, you know, that the most impact I can have is what I choose to do with my savings, my current account or my savings, is just not imaginative enough.
Totally agree with that. Why aren't we making transparency law? Why aren't we making sustainable development goals law? And also, in regards to this huge payouts to the corporate world, it's just another way in which the corporate world reproduces itself. So with huge payouts, it can buy shares and buy more controlling interests and keep the corporate world going. But my actual question from a deep green perspective is that we're living in a high impact country, the UK. We're operating at 3.7 planets. So in my opinion, we should be economically contracting. So specifically, my question is, how would economic contraction affect finance?
Right, great question. Who's going to take that one? The great thing about being a moderator is I can always just kind of shield it off. So.
Well, while the other two think about an intelligent answer to the to that one. No, I'm, well, okay, so there is an organization called the Global Alliance for Banking on Values, and they are thinking exactly along the lines of both reimagining finance and also thinking about how can we have a financial system that supports a series of changes that enable a more sustainable economy globally, or economies globally. And that means interacting with governments. It means taking small actions, but also sort of quite big actions. So we and the GABV interact a lot with the UN. So we partnered with writing some of the UN reports and the World Bank reports on what does a sustainable global financial system actually look like. And it's come out with a whole series of recommendations. It came out, I think, last year or the year before about diversity of the financial system. So having much, much more diversity in the financial system. At the moment, it's hugely concentrated. The five big banks in the UK have something like 85% of the current account market. You know, they dominate, totally dominate. So having a much more diverse financial system, having much, much more power of the markets in influencing the financial system, much more recognition of sustainability within the financial system. And I can't remember what the fourth one. There is a fourth one. But, I mean, basically, if you were to read that report, you would see a series of recommendations that talk about this is how we, the United Nations and the World Bank, and the banks that have contributed to that, want to see the financial system reimagining itself. And then more locally and at government level, you know, as I say, we've responded. We are directly talking to the Prudential Regulation Authority, which is the UK regulator, about, you know, trying to persuade them that the risks that are being run by big banks investing in carbon-dependent assets are actually not recognised in the level of capital. So a bank has to hold capital as a protection for for that bank in the case that everything goes horribly wrong. Okay, and it's supposed to be a reflection of the level of risk that that bank is running. So long as that level of capital does not reflect the level of carbon dependency within that bank's investment portfolio, it is not properly recognising one of the huge risks that the economy is currently facing. So that's the kind of thing that we are trying to do. And I would say, actually, Triodos, given that we started from the purpose of actually pointing money towards where social issues exist, actually, we kind of reimagined finance 30 years ago. We're just trying to persuade everyone else to catch up a bit. And if eventually, say, Barclays said, well, we're going to do it, it would be great. Our job here is done. You can have way more impact than we can.
So to the first question, I would just say I quit my day job to start a non-profit organisation that uses system science to reimagine how the biggest businesses in the world can make every dollar that they make to further the planet or society through that. So if that's not reimaginative enough for you, then you're a hard person to please. But you're right, we have to aim big. And the challenge of being on a panel like this is we're sort of trying to throw out day-to-day ideas alongside some of the, you know, big, audacious, hairy dreams that we all have. To your question, sir, the big challenge, the problem with growth is we've developed a global, mainly capitalist market where GDP, gross domestic product, is the thing. Financial growth is the thing. Even the guy who got a Nobel Prize in 1937, I think it was, for inventing GDP, said, whatever you do, do not use this to measure growth in the future. It was a measurement system that was invented to help America come out of the Great Depression. He said that, and then the world ignored him and took something that was not designed for that and used it for that, right. So what we now need to do is, if we are addicted to growth, growth is okay so long as we see it as being about social growth and environmental growth and not monetary growth. And it is possible, and there's a lot of very good work. Sounds like you've probably read a lot of it, and it's great stuff. But the problem is the world is just herring down this motorway of financial economic growth. Big companies, big government, it's probably where you've got some thoughts, Rob, you know, just driving down that route. How do we change off that motorway onto what we know is another system that could work? Right. And how do we democratically change all these things when we work in a 3 to 5 year cycle and all of these things are 10 to 20 year problems, and every chief exec or every prime minister who stands up and says, I want to do something different, will be out of a job within 6 weeks?
I mean, I guess that is the key point, is the democracy of it. I completely agree with what you're saying. I don't know if you've ever heard of a writer called Eric Olin Wright, who wrote a book called Envisioning Real Utopias. So he's part of a project called the Real Utopias Project. So utopian thinking is great, and I applaud it. But what the Real Utopias Project is all about is you know, viability. It's okay having kind of utopian goals, but we need to make sure they're viable and coherent, and they work politically, and that they're, you know, realistic. And you know, he emphasizes the importance of basically democratizing everything. You know, when we think of democracy, we think of it at a political level. And what he talks about is how we should extend it to other aspects of society. We shouldn't just think of it in terms of statism. And, you know, chief amongst that would be economic democracy. You know, you're in the cooperative's tent. That's exactly what cooperatives are all about, you know, economic democracy. And I think that's a major part of it. I'll give you a couple of examples that Eric Olin Wright talks about in his book. So one of them is, he tries to pick up on real world examples, and he kind of talks about how you can use those real world examples as inspiration. You know, they're actually happening now, so you know they're clearly viable. One of the examples is in Porto Alegre, where in Porto Alegre there's legislation's been passed so that local communities now actually have budgetary control over local budgets. They can actually, if anyone's been involved in local politics, it can be incredibly infuriating. You know, the council will often kind of ask for your opinion, they'll survey you, and it often feels like a kind of, you know, that they're kind of playing the game, but actually you're not being listened to at all. And I think a lot of people get cynical about democracy when they turn up to local political meetings, because they don't actually feel like this is what democracy is all about. So in Porto Alegre, they actually said, well, actually, we'll give you budgetary control over, you know, not the entire, you know, local budget, but over a certain percentage of it. And what they found was that people started to partake in ways they'd never partaken in politics before, because they felt empowered. They realized what democracy was all about. I think it's about, a lot of the time, it is about finding ways that we can democratize society and you know, not just, you know, hand it over to the rich and powerful. And the other example he talks about in depth is Mondragon. So, you know, I mentioned cooperatives. Mondragon is, you know, a network of cooperatives in the Basque region where, you know, it's not just individual cooperatives competing against each other. They're actually forming a network where they, you know, they all complement each other and they support each other by putting money into a central fund that subsidizes other cooperatives and that supports the cooperative movement, that has kind of councils and committees between the different cooperatives, and actually supports a kind of broader democratic economic movement. So I would advise reading that book.
Thank you. We've got a couple more questions. We are running right up against the clock, but there's a chap behind here who's, at least he's close to me, is it?
Yeah, I was interested by the first question that was asked and the responses it gave, because I've recently been reading a book by Peter Singer, The Life You Can Save. I don't know if you're familiar with... Well, he's kind of one of the main proponents of the effective altruism movement, and he kind of talks a lot about giving more to charity and how people in the first world can help the people in the developing world. And one of the things that he recommends is, say, yeah, do work hard and go and work in a bank or something. Because if you're earning a six-figure salary, then you can give six figures to charity. And though it's not what most people do, you can do a great amount of good for it. And he says that also, when people start doing that, it starts a cultural change. And if people know that other people like them, that they identify with, are giving these kind of sums to charity, then you're much more likely to be doing it. So maybe this is, because you're all saying that, no, they shouldn't be earning this much and almost kind of like discouraging people going into those jobs. But if he earns £800,000, he can give 770 or more thousand. Well, it's all of course tax as well. But he could give a huge amount to charity that can do a great amount of good, which is more than maybe many of us in our day-to-day lives will be able to help. So just...
I mean, you're talking about a massive cultural shift in that respect, but come this lady here's got probably an aching arm now.
I just want to ask, basically, it's interesting that you talk about making good financial decisions, but is it not important as well for us to be campaigning to ensure reform within the government to maybe pass legislation so that things like payday loan companies would become a thing of the past? I honestly think they should be banned. I think they should be illegal because they just set people up for financial ruin and, you know, pawnbrokers as well and gambling companies and things like that. Is it not worth sort of trying to get rid of these things so that people would have more of a positive and sensible mindset as to how they should be spending their money?
Well said. Well, this is the final comments because we're up against the clock, unfortunately. If anybody hasn't had a chance to ask a question, I'm sure the panelists will hang around for a bit to answer them, but we obviously need to close down. We could go on all evening, but I don't think that's quite what the organisers want us to do. So, Rob, start with you, just to kind of, in those two questions, maybe pick up a few threads on that and a few kind of final kind of thoughts as well.
I mean, the answer is yes, basically the short answer. Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of things, you know, that we could do at political level, and that's certainly one of them. Payday loan companies, certainly, you know, they shouldn't be allowed to charge ridiculous amounts of interest. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. And you know, another thing that I think is really important, actually, that the Labour Party have proposed is a national investment bank. And, you know, we need to invest more in, you know, in more socially productive and environmentally friendly things, and we need a national investment bank to do that. A lot of other countries, you know, Germany has a national investment bank, China does as well, and they've been, you know, they've nurtured a green industry that we just haven't been able to do in the UK. So, you know, that would be another suggestion.
Yeah, what he said. I'll take that one. I certainly never said don't earn lots of money if you can. The point I raised was why is that job paying that money? But I do struggle with the, I will go off and earn lots of money because what is the impact? What harm are you actually causing by doing that? And then, I'll just go and earn that money and now I'll give it away. Well, one, as the lady said, a lot of the time it doesn't happen. The lifestyle is very seductive. And also it's a very colonialistic approach. I know better, so I will go earn lots of money and then I will choose which charities to donate my dollars to because I know better than you. I've done a lot of work with the big NGOs over the year. I love what they do, but for me it's all about trying to drive sustainable development, not just giving charitable money away. So having not read the gentleman's book or knowing some of perhaps his more subtle arguments at a high level, I would object to quite a few of those. But I would say if you feel that you can find a good, high-paying, powerful job to go into where you can drive change, you can change how that business is doing its business and you can make positive change there. If you can earn good money doing it, which you can then pay the right amount of tax on and use that money to do good elsewhere, fantastic. More power to you. If you have the ability to do that, then do it. But do it well and recognise the snares that will be along that road.
Martin, the other thing is you could always then take a pay cut because you make the decisions and then you can put that back into the business. The business can give it away. So,
yeah, very, very briefly. So, yeah, credit unions, yeah. Absolutely. That would be, if we could really ramp up the credit unions so that the payday lenders simply had nowhere to go, that would be fantastic. We talked to them about that sort of stuff. I think just the other thing is that watch out, because rich people make bubbles. Okay, so one, as people get richer, so if you give a rich person another pound, they will probably invest it in an asset of some sort, like, you know, shares or whatever. Give a poor person a pound and they'll probably spend it on something essential like food or clothes or whatever. So what that does is it means that if you've got a whole bunch of people with a lot more money than other people, you get asset bubbles. Because all that happens is they're investing and trying to make money, and the, you know, there's a housing market or the stock market or whatever spirals upwards. Increases the economic difference, the wealth differential, quite dramatically. And trickle down just doesn't happen. So, you know.
Thank you. Well, that is going to be the close today. And, you know, pulling together all these questions, the thing is about, and come back to this lady, you know, we have a role individually, we can make an impact. And as a final kind of quote from a chap called Lucas Turner from a company called BuildOn, he says, education truly is the ignition for positive change and growth. So we can go out ourselves and work these things. And I finished yesterday, actually, because at least one of my children are here. I thought I'd finish with another knock-knock joke for those who were here yesterday. So, knock-knock. Dwight. Dwight Way is better than the wrong way. Please put your hands together and thank my panel.